This is Jay Sekulow on this broadcast today. Foreign and domestic issues facing the ACLJ.
Live from Washington, D.C., Jay Sekulow Live. Phone lines are open for your questions right now. Call 1-800-684-3110. And now, Chief Counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice, Jay Sekulow.
Hey, welcome to the broadcast, everyone. We're going to do something a little bit different and give you a heads up on a couple of major issues that we're dealing with. And to give you some more explanation of some of the issues that we deal with, but also some of the terms we're using. We've talked a lot. You've seen the rocket attacks in Israel this week coming in from Gaza have been pretty unrelenting. Not surprising, but there's a theory that goes in with all of this. And what that theory is, Hamas and Hezbollah in the north, Hamas, Sinai, Gaza area of Egypt will go ahead and lob rockets into Israel. Israel will respond by taking out various military structures. And then the Palestinian Authority, not, quote, officially part of Hamas and Hezbollah, but will then go to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. We've talked a lot about the ICC. We want to explain that in more detail in this program. You need to understand these international tribunals, how it interrelates with the United Nations. We're also going to take a look at this broadcast on a domestic side, a series of Freedom of Information Act cases that we have at the ACLJ. We're going to give you, and we're going to do this more often now, give you updates as to how those cases are progressing. Because one of the things that we realize when there's so many of them, and I get these lengthy reports that have the details in it. Obviously, we can't share that with everybody in the course of a 1 hour long TV and radio broadcast. But we are going to spend some time on these cases to at least get you updated. And then we're going to start producing a quarterly report on all of these cases so that you understand what we're dealing with. And it's a whole host of issues. Very broad area of issues in compliance that we're dealing with. One of the cases that I'm really paying a lot of attention to, we're going to talk about a little bit later, is a case that we have involving the Department of the State. And in it, the Carter Center apparently was getting money. It was being utilized for training, and it involved Hamas. And that violates federal law. So we're going to talk about that particular case and how that plays out with Andy Economo, one of our senior counsel's former United States attorney. We also have a series of cases, and that one, by the way, involves the State Department, and we're seeking records from the State Department involving funds or money that came from the United States that was given to the Carter Center and ultimately provided to Hamas or the People's Front for the Liberation of Palestine. We have filed a federal lawsuit on that case. We're going to give you an update on a series of these lawsuits. There's a lot of things to uncover here. Then we're going to talk about North Korea and some of the political consequences of the negotiations. How was it that the president so far looks like he's been able to get Kim Jong-un back to the table? So we've got a lot of things we want to unpack today. And rather than taking a lot of phone calls, what we want to do is spend our time talking with you, with our experts, to give you the analysis on this. So the next segment coming up, we're really going to get into the situation of what's going to happen in Israel. You know, it was just a week and a half ago that Skip and I were in Israel during the opening of the Jerusalem, the embassy in Jerusalem for the United States, a historic moment, no doubt. But we were already working on the legal issues that we would be facing. Some of those I'm holding in my hands right here. This is the European Center for Law and Justice, our ECLJ Strasbourg affiliate that files as an NGO to the International Criminal Court. We're going to get into all of that on the broadcast today. So again, we're not going to be taking a whole lot of phone calls. We'll take some, but really focusing on the work of the ACLJ, some of the major issues we're facing, and drilling down deeper so you understand the kind of the context of what the scope and nature of these cases are. When we talk about the International Criminal Court in The Hague, what does that actually mean? And how does it interrelate with the United Nations? How does it interrelate with our work around the globe? So when you talk about an ICC matter, we want to get into what that actually means. And of course, as I said, with the situation in North Korea heating back up, and it looks like a summit about to happen, how did that end up turning around so quickly? Literally in a matter of a weekend. Talk about all of that when we come back from the break. Of course, great ways for you to stay engaged with us at ACLJ.org and follow us on social media at Jay Sekulow, at Logan Sekulow, at Jordan Sekulow. We encourage you to do that. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
The life of an American pastor hangs in the balance. Pastor Andrew Brunson is on trial in Turkey. As you know, Pastor Andrew is facing charges of, quote, Christianization, on trial for simply living out his Christian faith. He could spend the rest of his life in a Turkish prison. At the American Center for Law and Justice, we're aggressively advocating for Pastor Andrew's freedom. We've mobilized our international offices. We're working directly with the State Department and alongside members of Congress. The Vice President is involved, and we've submitted a critical legal document to the United Nations. Stand with the American Center for Law and Justice. Fight for the freedom of Pastor Andrew. It's time to bring an end to this sham trial. It's time for Pastor Andrew to come home. Add your name to our petition right now online at aclj.org. It's a historic move. Now the United States has moved its embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, Israel's true capital. The state of Israel and its very right to exist is a linchpin issue not only in the Middle East, but represents a critical issue to the world at large. Whether it's the blatant and stated desire of ISIS, Hamas, Hezbollah, or Iran to wipe Israel from the face of the earth, or the more subtle but equally insidious aim to delegitimize Israel's existence through efforts at UNESCO, the goal is the same, to get rid of Israel. In his new book, New York Times bestselling author Jay Sekulow presents a powerful political and historical rationale for the existence of Israel as a sovereign nation. The official release date of the book is June 12th, but don't wait. Be among the first to be informed. You can pre-order your copy of Jerusalem, a biblical and historical case for the Jewish capital. Order now online at Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
I'm holding a letter in my hand that is a letter to the prosecutor, the International Criminal Court, The Hague, the Netherlands. This is on Israel's behalf. Here's the scenario that I've told you about, and this is what happens in every one of these incidents. There'll be a conflict with either missiles or mortar shells being sent into Israel from Gaza or from Hezbollah in the north. And then Israel will respond, as any country would if their civilian citizens were under attack, which is exactly what's happened in Israel. And then you could set your clock by this. The Palestinian Authority, which says we don't control Hamas and Hezbollah, but they will be the first group that takes action by going to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. We talk about that a lot. We've talked about it on the broadcast this week. I want to spend a segment here on the broadcast talking about what that actually means. So, Skip, let's define for Skip Ash, Senior Counsel for the ACLJ's, done a lot of work on our international matter, heads up our international law group and law of war and armed conflict. But we do a lot of work at The Hague, at the ICC. People don't realize that all the time, but, I mean, I've made multiple appearances before the Office of the Prosecutor at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Let's define for everybody what the ICC actually is, and that there is this kind of pattern of incident where there's rockets and mortar met by response, met by a legal action in The Hague.
Sure. The ICC is an international criminal court. It is a court that was created by a treaty called the Rome Statute. The United Nations has tried since the end of World War II to create some type of international body to deal with criminal offenses. It was be a follow-on for the Nuremberg trials, for instance. They wanted to set up a international court that could handle these types of issues. It did not happen because of the Cold War for many years, and not until 2002 did we finally get a treaty where a number of nations around the world agreed to set up this international criminal court. It's located in The Hague in the Netherlands, and it has control, it has jurisdiction over certain offenses. And so it's the court that everybody appeals to these days when they want to bring war crimes or crimes against humanity charges against a people like the Israelis.
So the United States is not a member of the, did not sign on to the Rome Statute, nor did Israel. So they're not members of the International Criminal Court. So there's a jurisdictional issue there before you even start these cases.
That's right. Under international law, if a nation is not a member of a treaty, that treaty is not binding on the nations that are not members, are not parties to it. So Israel, the United States, China, the Russian Federation, Turkey, Egypt, there are so many states in that area that are not parties to the International Criminal Court, and therefore they should have no jurisdiction, And that's one of our arguments over and over again, is that they can't bring charges against Israel because Israel is not a party to the treaty.
Here's exactly what we said in a legal brief that we filed with the court on May 21st. The subject line says, the issue of ICC jurisdiction, factual and legal analysis to assist the prosecutor in determining whether the ICC may lawfully assert its jurisdiction over nationals of the state of Israel, a non-consenting, non-party state to the Rome Statute. And the answer to that is no, they cannot. But this plays out, Than, in the context of the people need to understand that the UN is a component of this. The ICC kind of arrives out of the United Nations.
Well, a couple of points, Jay. First of all, the jurisdictional question that you're talking about is actually what makes it so important that the ACLJ and the ECLJ show up to advocate, because the United States cannot traditionally, like they historically have at the United Nations and at the United Nations Security Council. Now, Jay, I will say even that with a caveat, because if you back up just 18 months ago, the United States was walking away from Israel at the United Nations Security Council, which made it important for us to advocate there as well. But here's the bottom line. Someone has to show up at all of these international venues to defend Israel against these baseless charges, because if you look at the United Nations, Jay, Israel gets faced with more censures than every other nation of the world. Not Syria, not Nigeria, not Sudan. Israel has more censures against it than every other nation of the world combined. And when it comes to the International Criminal Court, the United States is not the one that can show up and advocate for them. So we have to, or I should say we get to. It's our honor to. But I would say at this point, it makes it even more important at the ICC than at the United Nations, because if the United States is taking the posture that we have historically, and we are again, then the rest of the world will follow the United States.
Let me take you inside the Hague in the International Criminal Court. So this is not like walking into the United States District Court for the Central District of California, or for the Eastern District of New York, or for the Northern District of Georgia. The ICC process is completely different. They have an Office of the Prosecutor, and that Office of the Prosecutor is the one who determines whether there is the ability to bring a case or not. So the first argument you have, especially when you're dealing with a situation like Israel, is whether there's actual jurisdiction to take place. You initially make that argument to the prosecutor. That's why our brief of May 21st focuses on jurisdiction. And what jurisdiction means is we argue that the court can't even hear the case because the Palestinian Authority, first of all, is not a state. Israel's not a consenting member state to the Rome Statute, which is what governs the International Criminal Court. Now, we've been successful with that already once, about 5 years ago, 6 years ago. But, Skip, there's been a bit of a change, or at least within the UN, there's been a bit of a recognition of the Palestinian Authority, more, and still not a state, but they argue more of a statehood. Where does that leave this? Because there is this pattern of attack from Gaza, from Hamas, Hezbollah in the north. Israel retaliates, and it's immediately there's filings at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Again, The Hague courtroom is not what you expect. We watched a criminal proceeding going forward about a case coming out of the continent of Africa, and this was nothing like the legal system we're used to here in the United States. But again, we probably filed collectively between both sides thousands of pages of legal documents on the first go-round of this about 2010 or so. And Skip, it took them 2 years to come up with a 2-page opinion saying no jurisdiction. I mean, we won, but it's so political. It's a political court, if you want to even call it that.
Absolutely. In 2009 is when the Palestinians tried to file for the first time, and that's what triggered our going to see the prosecutor at least on 2 occasions. And we won that, but it took the prosecutor, as you said, a number of years to come out with a 2-page solution that said, in effect, we can't hear this because Palestine is not a state. But then he said something else. He said, but I think it would be a state if the UN were to recognize it as a state. So what happened was the Palestinians then went to the Security Council at the UN, and they said no. So it went to the General Assembly, and the General Assembly overwhelmingly said that henceforth the UN General Assembly would treat Palestine as if it were a state, a non-member state. And based on that, the Secretary General forwarded that information to the prosecutor of the criminal court, who then is now treating Palestine as if it were a state.
But the question, Skipper, that everybody's listening to that just now saying, are they a state or are they not? And the answer that we get is they are not.
Absolutely. And that's what we've been telling the prosecutor. You're not a politician, prosecutor. You are supposed to be following the law. And Palestine does not meet any of the customary international law criteria for being a state. Therefore, it is not a state. And if it's not a state, it has no right to make any demands on the International Criminal Court, which limits all demands to states.
All right, Dan, I just took everybody inside the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Dingy, dark building. I mean, it's everything you don't think of when you think of a U.S. court system. Take everybody inside the U.N., which is another. I mean, it's a big building, big facility. But take people inside the U.N. to understand what the anti-Israel bias is, but also just the way that whole process works.
Well, when you sit in that General Assembly chamber, Jay, it's almost hard to imagine what you're hearing, because when the Organization for the Islamic Cooperation, which is the group inside the United Nations that basically has the controlling block of votes, when they send speakers down to the well, Jay, you never hear them utter the word Israel. You hear occupied territory, you hear Zionist regime, and then you hear censure after censure after censure introduced against the state of Israel. So, Jay, it is really an anti-Semitic body at its very core. And I would just say, look, traditionally, the arguments that Skip has been making on this broadcast, those have been made by the United States in that chamber in defense of Israel. And the collateral damage from the last administration that walked away from that posture is exactly why we are now having to take these defenses to places like the International Criminal Court.
So in The Hague, we've already started our filings. We filed two briefs. Skip, we're going to be filing more as well, because there's going to be more filed.
That's exactly right. Our next one is going to be on the issue of apartheid. They keep accusing Israel of being an apartheid nation, and we're going to blast that out of the water.
All right. So, again, the American Center for Law and Justice, our affiliate, the European Center for Law and Justice, based in Strasbourg, France, has NGO, non-governmental organization status with the UN, which allows us to intervene both at the United Nations and be recognized there, but also at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. So we're able to at least advocate our positions in defense of Israel, and again, in defense of liberty, really, because this whole system is in a very real way. I think you have to understand what you're dealing with here. It's the deck is stacked against Israel. But we've been successful as long as we push back aggressively, and we are doing just that. All right, coming up in the next segment of the broadcast, I want to talk about how do we get Kim Jong-un back to the table in Korea. The Trump Doctrine. How'd it work? We're going to find out on June 12th, it looks like. We're going to figure out how do we get there. That's a major change of events in a matter of days when the president sent the letter canceling the event. And then it was back on when the North Koreans responded. Skip Ash served in Korea, so we're going to get his insight as well. We're really getting into this issue in depth, so you understand the news. And we're about to have historic news affecting the globe in the next couple of weeks. We want you to be fully engaged, fully informed. So that's why we're going into these in depth today on the broadcast. We'll be back with more, including comments, when we come back.
It's a historic move. Now the United States has moved its embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, Israel's true capital. The state of Israel and its very right to exist is a linchpin issue not only in the Middle East, but represents a critical issue to the world at large. Whether it's the blatant and stated desire of ISIS, Hamas, Hezbollah, or Iran to wipe Israel from the face of the earth, or the more subtle but equally insidious aim to delegitimize Israel's existence through efforts at UNESCO, the goal is the same, to get rid of Israel. In his new book, New York Times bestselling author Jay Sekulow presents a powerful political and historical rationale for the existence of Israel as a sovereign nation. The official release date of the book is June 12th, but don't wait. Be among the first to be informed. You can pre-order your copy of Jerusalem, a biblical and historical case for the Jewish capital. Order now online at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. The life of an American pastor hangs in the balance. Pastor Andrew Brunson is on trial in Turkey. As you know, Pastor Andrew is facing charges of, quote, Christianization, on trial for simply living out his Christian faith. He could spend the rest of his life in a Turkish prison. At the American Center for Law and Justice, we're aggressively advocating for Pastor Andrew's freedom. We've mobilized our international offices. We're working directly with the State Department and alongside members of Congress. The Vice President is involved, and we've submitted a critical legal document to the United Nations. Stand with the American Center for Law and Justice. Fight for the freedom of Pastor Andrew. It's time to bring an end to this sham trial. It's time for Pastor Andrew to come home. Add your name to our petition right now online at aclj.org.
Hey, welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. We're getting into some issues at depth because we're about to witness history here in the United States, but really around the globe. You know, one of the great things about this broadcast is we're on, I think 1,000 radio stations in the United States, but we're also heard because of Facebook and social media, Periscope. We're heard around the world. We'll often get callers from all over the world, and we're about to witness some real history here, and that is in North Korea. Let's talk about this, and I want to go to Skip Ash first on this because Skip Ash is also Colonel Skip Ash, United States Army retired, and served in the demilitarized zone in Korea on the Korean Peninsula. Skip, this is an interesting dynamic that we've seen unfold over the last almost week now, and that is the president, everybody was planning for the June 12th summit. The president gets these no responses coming from North Korea. They stop responding. We cancel it. When I say we, the United States president sent out a very strongly worded letter basically saying to the North Koreans, don't threaten us with nuclear attack, which is what they did. Because our nuclear capability outdoes yours significantly. Also, letters coming forward in response, and then a statement coming forward from the North Koreans saying, we're willing to talk any place, any time, and now it looks like it's back on track for June 12th. Let's talk about the conflict, Skip. How significant is it that the president was able to get, it looks like at this point, Kim Jong-un back to the table? I know you've been very cautious about how this whole thing would play out from your experience.
Well, I think it is significant because Kim Jong-un, I think right now, is trying to figure out who Donald Trump is. You know, he's not the Obamas. He's not a President Obama. He's not a President Bush. He's not a President Clinton. He's somebody who has drawn a red line and actually looks like he's keeping it. I think what has really confused them in North Korea is the fact when they gave back our three citizens who had been captured there, in a previous administration, they would have been rewarded. They would have received some type of benefit. And what they received from the Trump administration was, thank you for doing the right thing. And that's it. And so I think what happens now is they don't know how to play the game because they don't have a president who's going to, every time they make even a promise that's not worth the paper it's written on, they get rewarded. Here's a president who wants to see action, meaningful steps taken before he's going to yield anything back. And while he's negotiating from a position of strength by keeping on these sanctions that are crippling the North. And also he has had some military maneuvers with the Navy around the Pacific and so forth, where forces are beginning to gather in that part of the world, which they are noticing in the North.
Do you think the June 12th summit will come off?
I think there's a good chance it will come off. It may not be on June 12th. It may be a few days either way, but I think there will be a meeting. Again, I'm not sure right now whether the expectations by both sides are within the same universe. You know, because I think when we think of the North Koreans, when they talk about denuclearization, they want the South, all U.S. forces out of the South, and they want all nukes that the United States has in the South gone.
Yeah.
Whereas we have a totally different expectation, and until we can come to some idea that we even have common definitions, it's going to be slow going, at least for a while.
So, Than, let's talk about the kind of political reaction. The Democrats were quick to jump on when it looked like it got canceled. They said, oh, this is failed diplomacy. The Trump doctrine doesn't work. He's a novice on this. And then all of a sudden, it looks like the North Koreans coming back to the table and that the event may happen on June 12th as originally planned, and you're hearing almost nothing.
Yeah, well, there's nothing much to say, Jay, because the message has really been consistent whether the summit was scheduled or canceled. The message has always been, we're going to keep the pressure on. We would like to have a dialogue with you, but we're going to keep ramping up sanctions until you prove that you are a good faith negotiator. And by the way, if you take strides towards that, we do want to have a good relationship with you, Jay. The important thing, I think, politically is the fact that this is no longer a threat that the president would walk away from these negotiations. He, in fact, did it. He sent the letter. He said, we're not coming unless you change course. Lo and behold, they changed. changed course. And Jay, I would just tell you this. You asked for a prediction on whether or not it happens. Let's look at worst case scenario. Let's say that it doesn't happen. There have still been significant strides forward. I would give you just a couple of them. The prisoners are home, but right. also better relations with South Korea. And China has been at the table calling for North Korea to make changes to their nuclear program. Both of those things are really very positive strides in the right direction. So worst case scenario, it's better than we were before.
No question. I mean, the hostages release itself was worth the negotiating. But here's the next question, and that is, Skip, in looking at what's going to happen, that's why I'm trying to drill down on this for our audience so you understand what we may be witnessing in the next 10 days could really be, or 12 days could be really significant. I mean, the fact that the event taking place itself would be significant, that the President of the United States meeting with Kim Jong-un. But people need to understand that this is not just trilateral negotiations. It's not just the United States, North Korea, and South Korea, Skip. This is multilateral negotiations because there's a lot of other players involved here, including China, Russia, and others.
Absolutely. I mean, that whole area of the world is concerned about what's going to happen from these talks.
Yeah, including Japan, by the way, who the president's meeting with on June 7th when he meets the prime minister of Japan. Yeah, go ahead.
Absolutely. And I think what's happened with the North Koreans, you know, they have pushed and pushed and pushed. And I think what's happened now is they have spooked the Chinese because the Japanese are talking about rearming and they're talking about getting their own nuclear weapons. If the Japanese were to do that, the Chinese have a long history with the Japanese and it's not been a pleasant history. So they want to dampen down some of this stuff, too. And then you have the North Koreans doing things and upsetting the apple cart for the Chinese. The Chinese want to have sort of stability in that region. They don't want to have a North Korea that becomes capitalist, but they don't want to have a collapsing North Korea either, because they're the ones who are going to get many of the refugees that come out of that. So there's a lot of pressures being applied on North Korea to act a certain way. But we have to remember that I think there was that secret trip there. Kim Jong-un has been to China twice, one of which was secret until he came back. And right after that visit is when they had this bellicose language. So I'm not sure even the Chinese got it right at that point in time. But the reaction by President Trump to say, OK, then we're out of here, we're just going to keep doing what we're doing, they brought them right back to the table.
Do you think, and I was going to ask you this, we're looking at the situation now as it exists. There is instability in the region, obviously, and the North Koreans are not predictable. And in that sense, you've got Japan and China, as you mentioned. You've got other portions of that world that are in play. When I say in play, because the instability there impacts other places. So, Skip, when I look at what the president's leadership strategy here is, he is negotiating very aggressively with the North Koreans. And he was willing to walk away from the table. And I think that's what it took to get them back to the table if it in fact happens.
Well, I think that's exactly right. I think that shocked them. They never expected that. They expected just the possibility of the North Koreans leaving the table, that the United States would pour out like we have in the past. We would bribe them to stay in. We didn't do that. We said, okay, we have finally recognized that we have a lot less at stake here than the North Koreans. The North Korean national existence economically is at stake. They're a basket case now and going downhill fast. And if we keep the pressure on, they're at some point in time, now that their army they're having trouble even feeding their army, that becomes a weaker element in their society. And that's the element on which the society is grounded.
So, Fan, let me ask you the political question here, because this is what everybody's thinking about. I mean, it's hard for me to believe that anybody would be hoping the president's not successful in this. What is that sense in Washington in the last 45 seconds of this broadcast, first half hour?
Well, the successes in this area are piling up, Jay, and there's not an elected member of the House or the Senate that wants to be on the wrong side of successes. So if the successes continue to pile up, I don't think you're going to have much opposition, even from the other side, especially when, Jay, what they're asked to engage in is so targeted. It squeezes China because of those shipping channels. I think you'll see them fall in line behind the president in the end.
All right, we've got a lot more to discuss coming up in the broadcast. We're going to turn our attention to some domestic issues. Remember, you can watch the entire broadcast at ACLJ.org, on Facebook and Periscope, if you're not getting the full hour. We'll be back with more, including some expert analysis on the domestic front.
The life of an American pastor hangs in the balance. Pastor Andrew Brunson is on trial in Turkey. We're working directly with the State Department and alongside members of Congress. The Vice President is involved. Stand with the American Center for Law and Justice. Fight for the freedom of Pastor Andrew. It's time to bring an end to this sham trial. It's time for Pastor Andrew to come home. Add your name to our petition right now online at aclj.org.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. We've been talking about international issues the first half hour. Now we're going to talk about domestic issues that we're dealing with at the American Center for Law and Justice. We're going to talk about a case we mentioned the other day involving a major win at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit for religious freedom, but also really for our national motto, and that is In God We Trust. We'll talk about that. But I also want to talk about our government accountability project. Let me tell you what this is. We initiated several years ago a determination that we were going to file a Freedom of Information Act request on issues, and I'm going to bring Andy Economo and Harry Hutchison into this conversation right away, on issues we thought would be of concern to the American people, where we think oversight is necessary, where Congress can do oversight, but they need outside groups that can look in and maybe even dig deeper or go to court to compel the production of documents if necessary.
That's right. And Jay, in connection with that and pursuant to that, the ACLJ has today a total of 51 ongoing Freedom of Information Act requests. These requests were sent to 15 different government agencies. 11 of the requests are in pending litigation. So there are actually 10 lawsuits, actual lawsuits, ACLJ versus the Department of State, ACLJ versus the Department of Justice, the FBI, the Treasury, that are pending in United States District Court in the District of Columbia, in which we are seeking information from these agencies to find out what went on in various matters and in various instances.
And a lot of this got initiated because of our litigation against the Internal Revenue Service. We filed a massive lawsuit representing dozens of organizations that were unfairly targeted by the IRS because of their conservative viewpoints, because of their pro-life positions. I even took in some educational groups in this that were talking about the Constitution. This was the targeting scandal from about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. We went to court on that, ultimately got an injunction, permanent injunction in place, monetary damages in a companion case to the tune of about $4 million. And that was really was the impetus, Harry, of starting a government accountability project inside the ACLJ. There you had an agency, the Internal Revenue Service, that was just focusing like a laser beam on conservative organizations and treating them differently than anybody else that was applying for tax-exempt status.
Absolutely. So the ACLJ is acting essentially as the eyes and ears of our members in support of improving government efficiency and compliance with the rule of law. So we have filed a variety of FOIA cases involving the funding of Hamas, the unmasking by Susan Rice, the unmasking by Samantha Powers, the inappropriate meeting between Attorney General Lynch and President Clinton.
Yeah, so there are a number of these that we're going to get into. We're going to focus on a few of them. But again, it all started when we started that case against the IRS with their Be on the Lookout list. And it was they were basically targeting organizations, Andy, based on the name of the organization, Constitution, Independence, Liberty. These were the hallmarks on which they would get special scrutiny.
That's right. They were looking at it. If you said something about patriots or you said something about Americanism, the IRS Exempt Organizations Division would target you for special treatment and special scrutiny. If we sent a request, or those organizations sent a request for tax-exempt status, they would literally be harassing them with asking them for more information and more documents and to keep delaying giving them exemption which they justly were entitled to. Through our efforts, Jay, we were able to cause the IRS to do a complete 180-degree turnaround down in what it was doing and how it was treating these organizations to reestablish and change its policy entirely.
All right, we're going to be back with more. We're going to discuss some of those cases. Again, we've given you an interesting look this week on the scope and nature of the work of the ACLJ, not just the headlines you read about in the papers or see on the news, but also the ongoing casework that it takes our lawyers time to do, but we're glad to do it, to get justice and liberty and freedom. All right, we'll be back with more, including a discussion of this significant cases involving the Freedom of Information Act, as Andy was just pointing out and Harry were discussing, but also we're going to get into this victory we had the other day at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit on our national motto, In God We Trust. So whether it's North Korea, Iran, Israel, whether it goes right back to the domestic issues here in Washington, D.C., around the globe, the ACLJ fully engaged. We'll be back with more, including your comments, in a moment.
The life of an American pastor hangs in the balance. Pastor Andrew Brunson is on trial in Turkey. As you know, Pastor Andrew is facing charges of, quote, Christianization, on trial for simply living out his Christian faith. He could spend the rest of his life in a Turkish prison. At the American Center for Law and Justice, we're aggressively advocating for Pastor Andrew's freedom. We've mobilized our international offices. We're working directly with the State Department and alongside members of Congress. The Vice President is involved, and we've submitted a critical legal document to the United Nations. Stand with the American Center for Law and Justice. Fight for the freedom of Pastor Andrew. It's time to bring an end to this sham trial. It's time for Pastor Andrew to come home. Add your name to our petition right now online at ACLJ.org. It's a historic move. Now the United States has moved its embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, Israel's true capital. The state of Israel and its very right to exist is a linchpin issue not only in the Middle East, but represents a critical issue to the world at large. Whether it's the blatant and stated desire of ISIS, Hamas, Hezbollah, or Iran to wipe Israel from the face of the earth, or the more subtle but equally insidious aim to delegitimize Israel's existence through efforts at UNESCO, the goal is the same, to get rid of Israel. In his new book, New York Times bestselling author Jay Sekulow presents a powerful political and historical rationale for the existence of Israel as a sovereign nation. The official release date of the book is June 12th, but don't wait. Be among the first to be informed. You can pre-order your copy of Jerusalem, a biblical and historical case for the Jewish capital. Order now online at Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
That we have 51 files in the Freedom of Information Act cases that we have, and 11 of those, or about a dozen of those almost, are in litigation. What that means, let's explain that for everybody because I think it's important. A Freedom of Information Act request is a statutory right that citizens have to find out about what their government's doing. It's a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act. The agencies are supposed to respond, but oftentimes, as we found out, that they don't respond, and then we go to federal court.
That's right, Jay. Sometimes many of the agencies, and the worst offender here, I have to say, is the Department of State, as
yes,
we have alleged many times, simply stonewall us and don't give us anything, absolutely nothing. They don't respond within the time set by the statute. They give us no documents. They give us no information. We follow up with them to see if they will. They don't respond to that. So to date, of all the FOIA cases that we have filed requests for, to date, we have obtained at least 11,000 pages of documents. But listen to this statistic. All but 70 of those pages were obtained only after we filed a lawsuit. Think about
that. Over 10,900 of those came because of litigation. So when you don't get a response, Harry, what you have to do and what we do in these cases to get the answer to why the government is doing something a particular way or had done something a particular way, you go to federal court. And that's where you get a motion and there's a time schedule and it's now supervised by the federal judiciary.
Absolutely. So we have exposed the stonewalling by several government agencies, including the IRS, including the State Department, including the Justice Department. And many of these agencies refuse to back down and comply with the law. Hence, we need to litigate these cases vigorously. Andy is absolutely correct. Without litigation, we would not get the documents, essentially.
So because of litigation, as Andy said, we have 11,000 pages of documents that we've obtained so far. And by the way, that gets updated every single month. All but 70 of those pages were obtained only after filing a lawsuit. So you can imagine here. But I just want to reiterate for everybody to understand what we're talking about. The ACLJ has a total of 51 ongoing FOIA requests out right now. These requests were sent to 15 different government agencies. 11 of these requests are in pending litigation. Two of these have been consolidated, so there are actually 10 lawsuits, although there were initially 11. They just consolidated one of them. One of the big ones, that one I'm very concerned about, and we know this because we just came back from Israel, so we know what's going on with Hamas, particularly in Gaza. And we you saw that the other day on the broadcast where the rockets were coming in. I was actually playing when the alerts were coming in. I played it so you could hear the alerts. I get that red alert app. So in this particular case, the ACLJ sent a FOIA request on March 1st of this year to the State Department seeking records of the State Department's involvement regarding funds or grants to the Carter Center, which is run and founded by the Presidential Library and Complex, an organization of President Jimmy Carter, as well as the State Department's awareness of any support or funds the Carter Center provides to Hamas or the People's Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Now, we know this happened because we saw documents in media reports that made us ask the question, Andy, what is going on here? You can't, funding Hamas with taxpayer dollars violates existing law in the United States.
That's right. Hamas is a terrorist organization. We have to understand that and we have to admit it. The government has found that to be the case, okay? Hamas is a terrorist organization operating in what is called Palestine, okay? What we found out is that the Carter Center, the Jimmy Carter Presidential Center in Atlanta, Georgia, has been funding Hamas terrorism. We wanted to know more about it, and we made a request to the State Department, a Freedom of Information Act request, and as you said, the complaint was served on April the 13th. The answer, because when you file a complaint in federal court, you get 20 days, the person who sued gets 20 days to answer, and they filed their answer, the State Department did, Jay, on May 13th, 2018, and the court has sent a joint status report briefing schedule due May 30, 2018. It is due. So we need to know, where are you, State Department, on giving us the documents? What is your plan? What is your procedure? What is your policy going to be on uncovering the funding by the Carter Center to Hamas?
You know, so it's the Carter Center to Hamas in one case. In another case, we find out that money went to another organization that was a Palestinian-led organization. And the funder there, or the, I should say the advisor, was Mahmoud Abbas. That's basically the president of the Palestinian Authority's son was the advisor. And the specific grant request talked about overthrowing Benjamin Netanyahu's government through an election, not violently, but to get, quote, center-left organizations organized to take out the right-wing government. That was in the request. And that was funded by the State Department as well. And we would not have known that unless we went to court.
Absolutely. So it's important to keep in mind this fact. Hamas is aligned with Iran and Hezbollah. So essentially, we have U.S. dollars helping and assisting Iran to produce regional mayhem. In addition, we are essentially supporting the Palestinian Authority in their efforts to come up with a weaker negotiating partner in terms of the country of Israel. In essence, the U.S. policy has been to eliminate the possibility of his reelection as prime minister. So in essence, the United States has violated its own rules in an effort to establish a policy which aids global elites at the United Nations, at the European Community, and in New York City and Washington.
Let me give you a couple of examples of FOIA cases, and we've had a good result. So do you remember the situation when James Rosen was with Fox News? He uncovered this issue of, when did we actually start negotiating with Iran? Now, President Trump has pulled us out of that so-called Iran nuclear deal. But there was this confusion about when the narrative that the Obama administration was putting forward was, well, this went on during when there was a more a moderate presidential election in Iran and on when Rouhani was in. And we find out actually that this actually started negotiating when Ahmadinejad was in power, who was calling for the destruction of Israel. and also calling the United States the Great Satan. So then there was this edit of a video, and they edited out the dates. We got all the information on that, and because of the FOIA litigation, we're able to determine that, in fact, it was an intentional act to distort the narrative, to change the narrative. Andy, we went to federal court, and we actually got the documents that said, yes, I received a call saying, edit this out, and they did.
Right. It was described as a female voice that was the one who did this. But, Jay, it required us to actually file a case in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia regarding the State Department's deleted video, which ultimately had caused them to have to admit that part of the Iran deal was a lie.
So here's another one. This just tells you the nature. I can't cover all 12 in litigation. I certainly can't cover all 51. But just because we've been talking about Israel and Iran this week and a lot of other issues, here's another one. ACLJ versus the Department of the State. You're seeing that the State Department is a frequent defendant in our litigation here. Here's what happened. We filed a lawsuit here because the Obama State Department was granting funds to a political opponents of Benjamin Netanyahu. We had a rolling production, which means each month they're required to produce documents. A state will finish its current production shortly. I mean, I think it's going to probably take another year. We wanted to brief the issues and wanted to get an expedited review, which we were able to get. I tell you, the State Department was not so thrilled about it. Here's why they were not thrilled about it. Because in the documents, guess what we find? That is, you actually find documents showing that the State Department knew that this group was trying to unseat Benjamin Netanyahu's government through email exchanges, through attachments. That's how you find it. And that's exactly what's happened in that case.
Right. Talk about collusion. Here is the...
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, this is the State Department.
Foreign government
under
interference.
Obama.
It's our State Department interfering with the Israeli elections.
Exactly. The State Department interfering with the elections in Israel to try to defeat Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister, and we're talking about collusion.
Yeah. So that tells you something there. Now, why do we bring these cases? We want to find out what happened. We also want to make sure, part of this is, Harry, to make sure this doesn't happen again.
Absolutely. These individuals need to be held accountable. Most of these individuals that are involved, they need to be fired expeditiously, but certainly they need to be removed from the State Department. It is certainly time, particularly at the State Department, to clean up the swamp.
Yeah, now I'll tell you something. That's the most interesting aspect of this, is when you find out who's on what email to whom and who they were talking to. And we found that out in the IRS cases. My goodness, they were talking to the Federal Election Commission. They were talking to people at DOJ. They were saying if we could just bring one criminal case, we could stop this down. And this is what the way they were talking about in the IRS cases. So on these now, we also get these redactions where you see these pages and pages where it's just completely taken out what the context is. And you go back to court on those seeking to find out what was being redacted. But again, what we're trying to give you today is a quick overview of the nature and scope of the cases that we're handling. So the first half hour of this broadcast, what are we talking about? We're talking about major issues. Major issues impacting the globe, right? And on this broadcast, or this section of the broadcast, this half hour, we're talking about stuff that affects us right here in the United States of America. Coming up, an update on that victory at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, defending In God We Trust, our national motto. So a really great decision on that one. So we're going to be getting into that. But again, we wanted to give you a sense on the broadcast today, the scope and nature of this broadcast, of our work. And you're getting to see that this Friday. As we now head into June or into June. And again, we encourage you to support the work of the ACLJ. And of course, you could do that at aclj.org. Stay engaged with us also on social media at Jay Sekulow, at Jordan Sekulow, at Logan Sekulow to get on our Twitter feeds, but also our other social media platforms that are available. We appreciate your comments coming in by Facebook and Twitter as well. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
It's a historic move. Now the United States has moved its embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, Israel's true capital. The state of Israel and its very right to exist is a linchpin issue not only in the Middle East, but represents a critical issue to the world at large. Whether it's the blatant and stated desire of ISIS, Hamas, Hezbollah, or Iran to wipe Israel from the face of the earth, or the more subtle but equally insidious aim to delegitimize Israel's existence through efforts at UNESCO, the goal is the same, to get rid of Israel. In his new book, New York Times bestselling author Jay Sekulow presents a powerful political and historical rationale for the existence of Israel as a sovereign nation. The official release date of the book is June 12th, but don't wait. Be among the first to be informed. You can pre-order your copy of Jerusalem, a biblical and historical case for the Jewish capital. Order now online at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. The life of an American pastor hangs in the balance. Pastor Andrew Brunson is on trial in Turkey. As you know, Pastor Andrew is facing charges of, quote, Christianization, on trial for simply living out his Christian faith. He could spend the rest of his life in a Turkish prison. At the American Center for Law and Justice, we're aggressively advocating for Pastor Andrew's freedom. We've mobilized our international offices. We're working directly with the State Department and alongside members of Congress. The Vice President is involved, and we've submitted a critical legal document to the United Nations. Stand with the American Center for Law and Justice. Fight for the freedom of Pastor Andrew. It's time to bring an end to this sham trial. It's time for Pastor Andrew to come home. Add your name to our petition right now online at aclj.org.
Hey, welcome back to the broadcast. If you're just joining us, so the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit in a case where the United States Congress was sued, as well as the Department of Treasury and the also the United States Mint, the United States Bureau of Engraving and Printing, the American Legion, and others. And we entered the case. They got listed as defendant appellees. I'm trying to figure that out. We were actually an amicus, but whatever. That's how the caption of the case reads. Yep. But the end result is defendant appellee or amicus, whatever. Well, the end result is the national motto stays. In God we trust on our currency, and they're not compelled to violate their conscience just because they have to use cash. Harry Hutchinson, our director of policies, just walked in our studio. We want to get his opinion on it, and we're also getting your calls at 800-684-3110.
Jay, the essential question is whether the national motto is unconstitutional government sponsorship of religion. And I think the answer is clear. The answer is no, because the plaintiff's case, the plaintiff's quarrel, is actually with the founders of the country.
Yep.
We are a nation founded on the notion that rights come from a creator and not from man. And if they don't come from man, they cannot be taken away by men.
So this is, I think, and let me read you a couple of quotes from the opinion. Allegations that the plaintiffs, because this is what they alleged, prefer to use cash do not show that the government has effectively forced them to choose between violating their religious beliefs or suffering a serious consequence, because your credit card doesn't have In God We Trust on it. They also say that plaintiffs' allegations, that this is the ones that sued, indicate that at least some legislators who voted to enact the currency statutes intended to promote a Christian monotheistic message. However, intent to promote one religion is not necessarily intent to suppress another. Plaintiffs' allegations do not show a specific governmental intent to infringe upon, restrict, or suppress other religious beliefs, simply, again, by putting In God We Trust as our national motto and putting it on the coinage. So, Andy, they were making this argument that it was kind of like a compelled speech situation, which was the same argument that they've made and lost, and now they've lost it at this court.
And they continue to lose, and will continue to lose it as long as the ACLJ is out there defending it and the use of it. You know, Jay, it brings me back to what one of the things that we said in our brief in the Sixth Circuit, and that is we quoted the Mayflower Compact. This was the first document, 1620, 400 years ago, Jay, when we sat down and the colony in Northern Virginia was put together. The Mayflower Compact was the first document that sort of put together what the society was going to be like in the New World. And what does it start by saying? That Bradford, William Bradford drafted. It starts as follows, not with anything else but this: in the name of God, amen.
Yeah.
We whose names are underwritten, and then it goes on and says, for the glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith, honor our king and country, and in the presence of God do covenant and combine ourselves in a civil body politic for better ordering and preservation of the ends aforesaid. So this nation has been founded on the belief of a deity, a supreme being and God, and we have defended and promoted that. The Sixth Circuit today has reaffirmed that.
All right, let's go ahead and take another call. We're taking your calls at 1-800-684-3110. Also, they says plaintiffs also argue that the currency statutes are facially discriminatory because the motto plainly associates the United States with monotheism. Again, the court said that was not a basis upon which the motto would be deemed unconstitutional. Go ahead, Logan.
All right, let's take some calls. Let's go to Terry in Georgia online.
Hi, Terry.
Hello. Hey. Thank you for taking my call. My question, Jay, is this is District 6 that you guys just
Sixth
won
Circuit.
In.
Yep.
And I know that they have the option of taking it up with the Supreme Court, and the court may not take it. But my question is, can a different district take this same issue and bring it before another judge? And their tendency is to just keep going until they get their way. So
They're trying to find a sympathetic judge. So here's how it works. They have two options on appeal here. What Mike Newdow, I said he's a good lawyer. What he could do is he could file for a motion to have the case reheard en banc, which, Andy, means the entire Sixth Circuit would hear the
case.
All
the judges of the Sixth Circuit, right.
Yeah, so that's one aspect. They could request for what's called a rehearing en banc. They do that and they vote, and if they decide they're going to rehear it, then they would rehear it. Or he could take it directly from here to the Supreme Court of the United States on a certiorari petition, which I suspect would – I don't know if Mike – he may go through the en banc process first because he got a dissent here. And then – take it to the Supreme Court and then hope that they get a review. So there's multiple ways it can go. But yes, it can be brought in other circuits. And in fact, there are other cases brought in other circuits. But I think if you look at existing Supreme Court precedent, I don't think there's a lot of risk here. I mean, I think you got to be vigilant because we've had that before where a judge in a circuit or a district court judge rules it unconstitutional. But Harry, when you look at the opinion, it seems well-reasoned.
Absolutely. And it's very consistent with Supreme Court precedent. In essence, the plaintiffs in this case are asking the courts to do exactly what the Supreme Court warned against in the Zorach case, that is to prefer atheism over religion, even to the extent of censoring the historical fact that the United States was founded upon a belief in God. So if you look at the Mayflower Compact, the Declaration of Independence, and the Gettysburg Address, they all contain religious references substantiating the fact that America's institutions presuppose a supreme being. So in essence, what the plaintiffs are seeking from the courts, they are asking the courts to erase American history.
Now, Than, you pointed out earlier, and I think it's worth reiterating, that we had a fight for this in the Capitol Visitor Center.
Yeah, we've had to fight for it in a number of cases. The Capitol Visitor Center was a unique one, Jay, because while so many of these cases involve the interpretation of statutes, including the National Day of Prayer and the national motto, both of which we go back to Congress and ask what they meant, in the Capitol Visitor Center case, Jay, they were challenging a statute that Congress had just recently passed. So you had the sitting members of the U.S. House and the sitting members of the United States Senate that had passed a law instructing the architect of the Capitol to include the national motto's inclusion, and then that did not happen. So we were able to go back to Congress and ask the very members who passed the statute what they meant by it. So the brief that we filed in that case carried a lot of weight. It was cited heavily in the decision that came down. And again, Jay, that is why it is now included when you walk through those doors of the Capitol Visitor Center. But Jay, I would say this, even in the cases of the National Day of Prayer or the national motto, when you go back to Congress and ask them, hey, what did you mean when you passed that statute? That carries a lot of weight when you present that to the court.
All right, let's go ahead and get another call.
Let's go to Pam in Pennsylvania on line 3.
Hey, Pam.
Yes. Greatly appreciate what you do. Strong supporter. I try to listen
Thanks.
Every day that I can.
Great.
And I think this is crucial. I think that, standing up for the nation's motto on our money is important. If that's lost, then there's more attacks on so many other.
Well, there's going to be, look, I mean, don't think that this is over because it's not. You can go to appeals, go to the Supreme Court, and there's going to be other cases like this. And I want to reiterate as we get ready to close the broadcast out, we had a fight for this at the Capitol Visitor Center because when you see the Capitol, when you see the where Congress meets under the dome, and you see the emblazoned on the speaker's dais, In God We Trust, that was going to not be in the Capitol Center. Well, we've talked about a lot of issues today in this broadcast, everything from North Korea to Israel to Hamas to the State Department and litigation domestically and a win at the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. But we wanted to give you on this Friday a scope and nature of the kind of work that we're doing here at the ACLJ, and you're getting to see it at the forefront here. And again, when you support the work of the ACLJ, this is what we're able to do. And again, thank you for supporting the work of the ACLJ in May. We met our goals, which was because of you, and we appreciate that so much. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.
The life of an American pastor hangs in the balance. Pastor Andrew Brunson is on trial in Turkey. We're working directly with the State Department and alongside members of Congress. The Vice President is involved. Stand with the American Center for Law and Justice. Fight for the freedom of Pastor Andrew. It's time to bring an end to this sham trial. It's time for Pastor Andrew to come home. Add your name to our petition right now online at ACLJ.org.